Welcome to the Healing Grove Podcast. I'm Dr. Kristen Ryman, an integrative holistic family physician, author of Life After Lyme, and host in this virtual space of learning, healing, and growing. I believe humans are like trees, and our physical limb is only one of many. Health on all limbs of the tree, emotional, conceptual, social, spiritual, is absolutely required for the whole tree that is you to be vibrantly well. I created the Healing Grove Podcast as a place to showcase some of the world's best integrative and holistic medicine, to expose you to transformative tools and mindset shifts for all limbs of your tree. I hope you enjoy our conversation in the Healing Grove today as much as I enjoyed having it.
Hey everyone, I'm so excited to introduce you to my new friend, Dr. Daniel Kinderlehrer. Dr. Kinderlehrer is a nationally recognized physician with expertise in the fields of nutrition, allergy, environmental medicine, Lyme disease, and the healing of mind, body, spirit as a unified whole. Dr. Kinderlehrer co-founded the New England Center for Holistic Medicine in Newbury, Mass., and has taught extensively, including practitioner training courses at the Omega Institute, the National Institute of Behavioral Medicine, the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, and the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, or ILADS. He created and organized the Lyme Fundamentals course, which is presented annually at ILADS, and actually, which is something that I took 10 years ago, maybe. I don't know if you were creating it back then, but it was awesome and remains so. And he's also the author of several articles in medical journals, The Lyme Times and Psychology Today. His integrated medical practice in Denver, Colorado, focuses on the diagnosis and treatment of tick-borne illnesses. Dr. Kinderlehrer is the author of Recovery from Lyme Disease, the Integrative Medicine Guide to the Diagnosis and Treatment of Tick-Borne Illness, which was released in 2021, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and my introduction to that book was actually at ILADS this past October. I met you at the author's table. Your book was there next to me and my little picture of my ebook. And I said, tell me about your book. And you said, it is the best Lyme recovery manual out there. And I was like, oh, cool, because it's sitting right next to my book. I got to read it and see what I missed. It actually is an amazing book, super thorough. I would recommend it for anyone looking for a very comprehensive overview of not only tick-borne infections, but how to kind of think about them in a holistic way and recover from them. So I think it should be on everyone's doctor's table. You know, like if you're sick out there with Lyme and you're looking for something you can hand your doctor that's well-researched, very clear, well-organized, and comprehensive, that would be the book I would give them. So thanks for being here. It's really nice to have you in the Healing Grove. I know we have a lot of things we could talk about today. We were sort of brainstorming what it was going to be. But before we get into any of those, I really would love for you to share with us your story about how you came to this important field of study and practice.
Interesting question. So here's what happened. I did a residency in internal medicine. When I finished that, the last thing I wanted to do was practice internal medicine, which it seemed like we didn't cure anything, that all we did was try to deal with chronic problems, heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was one of the early practitioners that opened up a holistic medical practice, really hoping to practice particularly preventive medicine. But, you know, that eventually became what we now know as an integrative medical practice. Ended up doing a lot of environmental medicine in that context. And then in 1996, I got sick. So this was August of 1996, and I had a fever of over 103 degrees. I was shaking chills. I had profound sweats. I had aching all over. It lasted 2 or 3 days, and then I was okay. And I figured, well, I guess it was some sort of virus. I did not see a tick bite. I did not see a rash. I did live in eastern Massachusetts. And the next week, I was better up until about 8 days later, it came back. Another 2 days, and it went away again. So I was in denial at that point. I said, well, okay, some recurrent virus and now I'm okay. But when it returned the second time, so now I had three episodes, I said, okay, I got to get checked. So I saw a friend of mine who's a family doc. He examined me. He said, your spleen is enlarged. And he ran just routine blood tests and they came back with some mild abnormalities in the liver enzymes, but a positive Lyme test, very positive Lyme test. Well, I thought that was good news, you know, 1996. Well, just take a course of antibiotics and I should be fine. And that's what I did. I went on antibiotics. But what happened was the symptoms morphed. So I developed insomnia. Now, I had been an Olympic sleeper. It drove my wife crazy. I put my head on the pillow in less than 60 seconds. I'm gone for 7 hours. Well, now I could fall asleep sort of okay, but every night I'd wake up earlier and earlier and earlier. And I developed profound anxiety. I was a relatively laid back, easygoing guy. And now I was more like 9 out of 10 anxiety all the time. It was awful. So I'm dealing with sleeplessness and anxiety. I would lie in bed most of the night shaking. And I'm still on antibiotics a month later, repeat a blood test, even stronger Western blot for Lyme. And I put a call in to a famous Lyme doc who certainly then would have been considered maybe the world expert, Alan Steer. Alan Steer was at Tufts, which is where I went to school. And back then you could call him virtually any doctor and they would call you back. It's not so easy now. So, you know, he was very cordial, old school even. He called me back and I presented my case to him. And his answer was, well, you don't have Lyme disease. And I said, why not? Well, he said, the tests must have been wrong. If you had Lyme disease, you'd be better by now. And I said, well, what do you think I have? And he said, something else. And that was the conversation. So
from the preeminent Lyme doctor in the country at that point.
Exactly. So because I didn't respond to treatment, I didn't have the disease, despite the fact that I had two really highly specific laboratory tests. And it was interesting. So he was categorically wrong. I had Lyme disease. There's no question I had Lyme disease. But he was also right. I had something else. If you, Christine, or I, or any competent Lyme doctor was out there and heard my story, they'd say, you have Babesia. I mean, Babesia causes enlarged spleens, elevated liver tests, and high fevers with shaking chills and night sweats. And by the way, it can also cause insomnia and anxiety, you know. But Babesia was under the radar back then. Very few people knew anything about Babesia back then. So despite the fact that I stayed on antibiotics, I really didn't get better over time, waxed and waned, took like another 5 years before I was diagnosed with Babesia, and eventually also with Bartonella. So what I would say, finally, in answer to your question is, when I recovered enough to be highly functional and reasonably intelligent, I said, I really want to do everything I can to help people with this problem. It's very clear that most doctors have no idea what it's about, what to do, how to evaluate it. And I'm going to limit my practice to seeing people with tick-borne infections. So that's how I got here.
And that was how far into your professional career at that point?
Well, it was 1996 when I was infected, and it was around 2000, somewhere between 2000 and 2002, that I had a practice. I mean, I was totally disabled for a while. It got really bad, particularly the neuropsych symptoms. I had panic attacks. I had desperate depression, suicidal depression. Life was really, really challenging.
Sounds very painful. Do most of your patients nowadays have similar degrees of severity that you did? Because you had a pretty severe case.
Right. It's interesting. I suspect this is true for your population of patients as well, Kristen. It's all over the map. But I can say that it's unusual that I see someone who does not have neurological Lyme problems. As you know, the vast majority of symptoms are musculoskeletal and neurological. In Europe, where Lyme disease was described for decades, even though it wasn't called Lyme disease, there were a lot of articles about the neurological symptoms associated with this infection. And also, by the way, that penicillin cured it. All of this preceded the studies that came out in the late 70s in Lyme, Connecticut, so which sort of rediscovered something that was already discovered. And I do see people who've had neuropsych problems as severe as mine. There's no question about it. I would say most of my patients aren't that bad, but I see it really, the most upsetting is when I see it in children, kids with PANS, PANDAS-like syndromes, where they go from severe anxiety and depression to even psychosis. So upsetting to everybody, obviously to the patient as well. You know, the great part is you save a kid like that, they got their whole life ahead of them.
Yeah, let's dig into that a little bit. I think PANS and PANDAS is still a relatively new term for people. Well, for people who don't experience it, have no point of context for it, or may actually know a child with it, but don't. That hasn't been the diagnosis, right? The diagnosis is bad behavior or ODD, or, you know, there's other labels that are given children who kind of act so bizarrely and or so violently at times. Can you give us kind of the general overview of PANS and PANDAS so that a newcomer to this topic would have a little bit point of reference?
Sure. Okay. I'm going to start with rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is, in general, a kid gets a strep throat, and then antibodies to the strep attack the heart valve. There's some structural similarity between the heart valve and the strep. The immune system gets a little confused and said, okay, I'm going to go after those heart valves. And so it's an autoimmune illness, and it's an infection. Okay, we know about conditions like that. What if the antibodies to the bug, instead of going after the heart valve, go after the brain? So that's called autoimmune encephalitis, and that's what we're talking about here. So around 1994, Susan Sweeto at the National Institutes for Mental Health first described this condition. And then in 1996, had 50 cases, and that's when she introduced the term PANDAS, stands for pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disease associated with streptococcal infections. So here are these kids. They're perfectly fine, neuronormative, and they get a strep throat. Big deal. You put them on amoxicillin, and then they fall off a cliff, develop severe OCD, all sorts of mood and behavioral problems, including restricted eating and sometimes really severe anorexia. And it turns out they have inflammation in the brain. So technically what we're talking about is autoimmune encephalitis. Okay, this is a big deal because it turns out it's not only strep that does this. We now know almost 20 different bugs that can trigger this. And by the way, COVID can trigger this. Other viruses can do it, including Epstein-Barr and HIV and so on, and other herpes viruses. But in addition, some tick-borne pathogens can trigger this. The specific pathogen, which is really well established that does this, is Bartonella. We could talk about Bartonella in more detail if you'd like. Oh my God, Bartonella's the worst. I think we all see, docs like you and I, all see so much neuroinflammation associated with this pathogen. And just think about it, Bartonella's, there's a lot of Bartonella around. We'll come back to Bartonella. Mycoplasma, which is generally a respiratory pathogen, but can also be tick-borne. That also can produce a lot of this autoimmune inflammation of the brain. And then there's Lyme. I've written a couple papers on this. We actually don't know if Lyme can do it. There's good reason to suspect it can, but it's going to be very hard to separate out Lyme from co-infections. Frankly, I don't see Lyme without co-infections anymore, even with acute Lyme. Even when someone was perfectly healthy up until a month ago and comes in, in fact, this happened fairly recently. I saw a guy with, he actually presented with Lyme meningitis and was hospitalized. And they contacted me. I said, well, make sure they test him for co-infections. He came out top positive for Babesia. But then I subsequently diagnosed him also with Rickettsia spotted fever group and also with Bartonella. So there you go. Four bugs.
Well, I mean, that lines up with the studies that have been done on actual vectors, looking at ticks and fleas and sandflies and things that carry these bugs, right? That they're often, more often than not, multiply infected themselves. So it makes a lot of sense that they'd be transferring things in, you know, a variety pack, basically.
You got it. You got it, Kristen. So in fact, there's a paper out there that says polymicrobial infection is the rule, not the exception. There's several papers that support that. So anyway, I don't know how we separate out Lyme from these other pathogens. I and I'm sure you and a ton of other Lyme doctors see Lyme in association with autoimmune encephalitis, PANS and PANDAS-like syndromes. But there are these other bugs there too. And how do you know which one is doing it? Or maybe it's all of them together. I actually just submitted a paper for publication, and it's called Polymicrobial Tick-Borne Infections. Think about this, PANS and Autoimmune Encephalitis, a series of five cases. And each one of them, each of the five cases had at least three microbes that we could document. Okay, so these poor kids, they classically will present with severe OCD and or restricted eating and anxiety and depression and mood swings and sometimes violence, anything from severe temper tantrums, I mean like Chernobyl type meltdowns, to being really aggressively violent. I mean, beating up their siblings, basically the father has to hold the kid before the kid destroys the house. And interestingly, more often than not, the kid is sorry about it afterwards. Did you notice that too?
Yeah, I've noticed that. And I've also noticed some of them don't remember. Like, it's like they were so inflamed in the moment that they weren't making memories, but they either see the video, right, that the parents took with their iPhone, or they remember the last little wisps that they see with the last, the chaos that's around them. And they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. But they don't, I have a lot of nonverbal kids who I work with and they're not telling us, but the kids who can talk sometimes say, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that ever?
I have seen it. Not very often though. Yeah. It's almost like a fugue state, Really fascinating and not surprising when you think about all that inflammation, right?
Sure.
So, and then, the decline in their cognition, et cetera, et cetera. So the treatment, one has to be treating symptoms, if, you know, and the kids may or may not respond to some psychotropic meds to try to calm their nervous system. And antibiotics for sure, which we have to be very careful and very slow because a Herxheimer can just drive them nuts. And then third is anti-inflammatory. So those are the main things, but it's also important to remember that these kids don't just have inflammation in the brain, they have systemic inflammation. And because of that systemic inflammation, they develop multiple sensitivity syndromes. And most of my patients, and I'm sure yours as well, have food sensitivities that they probably didn't have before this, but dairy, eggs, gluten, sugar, yeast, corn are the most common ones I see. And I have patients where if they have a little bit of corn, boom, they're gone. Or a little bit of sugar, anxiety attack. Mm-hmm. And then they become sensitive to mold. They weren't sensitive to mold before, but now they are. And we got to treat mycotoxin illness and mold sensitivity. And they develop mast cell problems, right? And mast cell and dysautonomia go together. And so we have autonomic problems. I mean, poor kids. But this is something that a practitioner needs to know about because we got to treat the whole patient and give tons of support to the family, everything, and let them know they are going to get better. It's just going to be slow, not easy, one small step at a time. Here's something that's really important. Now, there's criteria for PANS. So PANS refers to PANDAS, but now says two things. One is it's no longer limited to children. It includes adolescents up to 18 years old. The second is it can be any microbe or even a non-microbe that triggers this. The PANS stands for Pediatric Acute Onset Neuropsychiatric Syndrome. I think it's a terrible name. And one reason is because it's not just pediatric. And the second is it's not just acute onset. And that's a real problem. That's a real problem because doctors who don't know any better may interview a kid who's basically looks like PANS kid, but it was more of a stuttering onset, started with a little bit of anxiety and so on, and maybe then some tics, you know, the kind of thing, and then eventually manifested a lot of this stuff. It maybe never even had OCD or restricted eating, but otherwise really looked like they had a PANS, so we'll call it a PANS-like syndrome. But because they didn't meet these case criteria definition that came out in 2013, right, from the NIH, the case definition criteria is they have to have the acute onset or the abrupt onset of OCD and or restricted eating, and two of the following, which are the things we talked about, the anxiety panic disorders or the depression and mood disorders, and then the behavioral problems and the tics, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well, I wanna expand this concept of autoimmune encephalitis. The case definition, it is important. It's important to have a case definition because when you study a group of people who have a diagnosis, you need to define what that diagnosis is and make sure everyone fits that diagnosis so that when you're doing interventions, et cetera, you can compare that to people who don't have that diagnosis. Okay. But it's used inappropriately. It's used inappropriately by doctors who say, well, you didn't have the abrupt onset of this, so therefore you don't have PANS. Wrong. You know, I would say at least half or more than half of my patients did not have that abrupt. It happened on August 1st of 2019. Most had this more stuttering onset. Okay.
Yeah. And it sounds like if it stutters you into the past 18 age, then suddenly you're no longer eligible for a diagnosis for that reason. Right.
And
because you're no longer you pediatric.
Yeah. So, and I want to come back to that one. Thanks for mentioning. Okay. So one is it doesn't need to be an abrupt onset. And here's another one, which is It doesn't even have to look the same. I want to tell you about a paper I published. This is a good story. I started with a 16-year-old girl who came to my office with anorexia nervosa. Basically, she kept on trying to lose weight despite the fact that she didn't need to lose weight whatsoever. And she had a body image that said she needed to lose weight. And she was actually in and out of an inpatient outpatient eating disorder units 5 times. They could not get her to eat. Excuse me. She had a nasogastric tube in, and that's how she was getting all her nutrition. She at least usually wasn't pulling that out. And she had anxiety and other symptoms, of course. So this was in the Colorado. She lived in Colorado Springs, but she had grown up in upstate New York. And anyone living in upstate New York will say, uh-oh. And the mother was a nurse and had her tested for Lyme. It came out positive, and that's how she ended up in my office. Okay. It turns out she actually had Bartonella stria. And she interpreted those stria as stretch marks, added indication that she needed to lose weight. So this is written up. There's an article in the PubMed. You can check
and
it
just
out.
For people who don't know what stria are, they look like stretch marks, but they don't follow the kind of Langer's lines, right? They don't follow this where the skin lines are and therefore where stretch marks should be if they were actually just from being overweight and gaining weight quickly. And this is a common thing in Bartonella and some other of the tick-borne infections too, but Bartonella is just classic for this. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's almost pathognomonic for Bartonella.
Yeah.
You can biopsy these and find Bartonella. Just like you said, Kristen, they're in different planes of the dermis, and they're actually a different level of the dermis than stretch marks. And she said, well, you know, I obviously need to lose weight. So she also had mycoplasma, let me see, and babesia. Okay, she had 4 tick-borne infections. And we had her on intravenous antibiotics for a few months and then oral antibiotics for a year. She was cured. She's actually doing well. I actually talked with her mother just this past week because other kids in the family are having problems too. And so when I saw her and she got all better, which was pretty much a miracle. Anorexia nervosa is not actually considered curable, but
But how much of that is because we're not actually treating people for the underlying reasons for the anorexia nervosa?
Well, isn't that a good question? So I designed a study for anorexia nervosa and looked around. It was very hard to find someone who is in charge of an eating disorder clinic to help me with this study. And frankly, it's a big business, and I don't think they wanted to change their business plan and actually look for something that cures these people. That's a side comment, and it's really cynical, but that was my impression. But I did find someone who was very interested, and we got a study started. And sadly, the individual who was head of a large eating disorder unit in Massachusetts, he didn't follow through. He never enlisted the patients. And that was it for the study. It was very upsetting to me. I put a lot of work into it. So, and what we wanted to do is basically take 25 individuals with anorexia nervosa, test them to these tick-borne infections, test them in the Cunningham panel, which, as you know, is the antineuronal antibodies, and compare them to a control population. Well, here's the next best thing. There is a woman who was a physician who was sitting in with me. Pre-pandemic, I had doctors sitting in with me all the time. And she said, you know, I'm medical director at this residential treatment center for adolescents up in Estes Park, which is right at the foot of the Rockies. Let's see if I can get permission to test these kids. So we did. We got an IRB, and we tested 10 kids at random. And out of these 10 kids at random, by the way, they were all diagnosed with major depressive disorder. 10 out of 10. 7 out of 10 were diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. Only one of these kids had a known organic disorder, and it was celiac disease. And 4 out of them had made significant suicide attempts. And we tested them to tick-borne infections. We tested them to what Igenex was willing to offer for free, okay? Not include Babesia, but did include Lyme, Bartonella, and tick-borne relapsing fever. And to make a long story short, 6 out of 10 clearly had evidence of infection with one or more of those three. Depending on interpretation of the Western blots, it could have been 9 out of 10. Okay, but clearly, but definite 6 out of 10. Three of them had anti-DNase antibodies, so three of them had elevated strep antibodies. But get this, Kristen. 9 out of 10 had positive Cunningham panels. And I want to thank Molecular Labs for donating that.
Wow.
9 out of 10 had autoimmune encephalitis. 9 of these kids out of 10 had brain on fire. And this blew us away. And I want to really, really emphasize this because kids don't have to have a PANS-like syndrome to have autoimmune encephalitis.
Yeah.
And I look at what's happening in the world today. We have the convergence of three epidemics. Okay. One epidemic is Lyme disease, not just in the United States, worldwide. There was a study that came out, I think, the past year. 15% of the world's population has or has had Lyme disease. 15%. Okay. Autoimmunity. That we're seeing increasing numbers of people developing autoimmune problems, not just in the US, throughout the world. And then the third one is mental health disorders. And you take those three, and you're developing basically an epidemic in neuropsychiatric disorders. And so we're seeing that specifically in PANS, but it's not just PANS. What about just people who develop anxiety disorders out of the blue and develop depression out of the blue, or OCD, or guess what? Psychosis. There is a huge amount of data now that's published. It basically links mental illness with inflammation. And this hasn't filtered down much into the practicing psychiatric world, but when they're testing people with anxiety, with depression, with bipolar, with acute psychosis, they have really significant elevations in cytokines, which, as you know, are inflammatory markers, and elevated CRPs. It's really huge, particularly treatment-resistant depression, serious inflammation. Autoimmune illnesses have a high incidence of mental health disorders and so on. I actually wrote a paper that's under review now, and the title is Stress, Inflammation, Mental Illness, Autoimmunity, and Chronic Disease, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. It's like there's inflammation throughout this. And if it's okay, Hugh, I'd like to talk about PTSD.
Yeah, definitely. I want to make one comment before we go there because I think a lot of people hearing this, depression and anxiety, these diagnoses have been so kind of widely kind of accepted. And I think it's both positive for people who are struggling to see that it's, that there's help and that there's an answer and that they're not alone, right? But it's also very, I think, disempowering to think that, now you have a disease that we have a pill for that you'll be on for the rest of your life. And by the way, that pill does nothing to actually cure the underlying problem if it's something like Lyme or if it's something like mold or if it's something like Babesia. But I was just thinking as you were talking about depression and how people get diagnosed with depression right and left. And one of the mnemonics we learned as medical students was Sigi caps. Remember Sigi caps?
Yeah.
Like was like a mnemonic to remind us, like, here are the sort of symptoms or clinical signs that go along with depression to make you think, oh, this person might have depression as a diagnosis. And it's sleep, which was off for you, interest in doing things, which of course tanks when you're sick from these illnesses, guilt, which we've already talked about, remorse for behaviors and things that you didn't feel under control of, low energy or changes in energy, changes in concentration, appetite. We've talked about that. Psychomotor or, you know, sort of mental and physical slowing, and suicidality. Like, basically it's a hit list for all the things that can be going on in people who have autoimmune encephalitis. So I just want to, if people haven't gotten this yet from the conversation so far, and you're struggling with a diagnosis or symptoms of depression or anxiety, please consider asking your provider to look into tick-borne infections. And of course, that's a whole other ball of wax to get into, like whether or not they're going to say yes or no, and how they're going to look for it is going to vary from person to person. But at least in your mind, start looking into this possibility, because there is help and hope for these things that often people are told, yeah, you're just going to have to live with depression or anxiety forever. You're just an anxious person, here, take this pill.
You know, what you said is so important, Kristen, because as you know, if someone presents with most of those symptoms in your acronym, the doctor says, oh, you're depressed. And either they get a prescription for an antidepressant or they're sent to the psychiatrist, but no one is looking for an underlying organic disorder. Yeah, I mean, it's really a problem, a huge problem. And then even if the doctor is willing to test for Lyme, you and I both know most don't know how to properly test for it or even interpret the test. Okay, yeah. Sad state of affairs. So, I want to talk about PTSD and Lyme, and I'm gonna try to have people picture it like this. Here's your mental psyche, and here's your brain that's inflamed. Okay, so with PTSD, there's an outside trauma, terrible things. You know, rape, childhood abuse, war victims, etc. Okay, and that input into the psyche leads to this hypervigilance in the limbic system, the amygdala. I won't get too technical here, but it generates symptoms that we typically think of as neurological, you know, the flight or fight reaction when we go into like alarm states and panic, etc. But our nervous system isn't really separate from our endocrine and our immune systems. It's really all one system. And so what happens in addition to those awful neurological symptoms is the immune system goes wacko and develops a lot of inflammation as well as immune suppression. Huge. This is super well documented. And where does that inflammation most manifest? In the brain. And what does that do? It goes back to the psyche, where that inflammation triggers more limbic response. And now you have a cycle. Okay. It's really bad. Now, I digress. I want to mention that there's more and more papers, original research papers, talking about this. And they're talking about how stress and trauma result in neuroinflammation, and the neuroinflammation results in stress and trauma and mental illness. And the term that's used for this is bidirectionality. Okay, it goes both ways. So what if instead of an awful event like rape or war, what if it's an internal event like an infection, and this infection is generating autoimmune inflammation in the brain? Then that neuroinflammation is hitting the limbic structures, generating these awful emotional symptoms and more neuroinflammation. So it's sort of like it can come in like this, okay? I would say the people I see who have the most challenging times with recovery are people who have a history of PTSD from, sadly, you know, child abuse and court trauma, and then get tick-borne infections on top of it. Yeah. I'd say those people have, I'm not saying they don't recover or can't recover. I'm just saying they have the most challenging time, you know, because you have to start working on belief systems at the highest level in terms of dealing with their helplessness and hopelessness and so on. These poor people, they've been so triple whammied, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's what's necessary. So, you know, it's interesting. I hope people know about Bessel van der Kolk and his book, Your Body Keeps the Score. So, as you know, I used to practice in Massachusetts. I actually knew his family, but I never met him. And while I was seeing patients with severe environmental illness, you know, these are people who, I had patients who lived out in the woods because if someone within a mile walked with perfume, they'd have an asthma attack, you know, that kind of thing. You know, they were down to three foods and couldn't be near anything with chemicals, couldn't go into public places, you know. So we were seeing probably the most sensitive people in northern New England in my clinic. And it was very clear to me that the vast majority of them had problems with, well, had histories of significant core trauma abuse in childhood. And Bessel van der Kolk was talking about, you know, these people I'm seeing who are people who have child abuse, histories of child abuse. He said, they have a lot of physical problems. We're seeing the same people. Mm-hmm. And I just want to use the word hypervigilant. You know, people with these history of child abuse, they become very intuitive, right? They can tell the way the door closes when their father comes home, whether they're in trouble or not. They might be able to tell before their father even hits the driveway. They're really, their nervous systems are on high alert. Well, guess what? So are their immune systems. Unfortunately, when their immune systems are like that, they're reacting to a whole lot of things. We cannot separate out the nervous system and the immune system, nor the neuroendocrine system. So I just wanted to get that across to people, how really, well, you know, Western medicine has talked about mind-body connection. I would make it more mind-body universe. And they sort of can, I would say the mind sort of contains the body. And it all needs to be addressed. It all needs to be addressed. And then I'm going to continue to riff a little bit. This is so sad, but I want to introduce people who are listening, if they don't know this term, epigenetics. So as you know, genetics takes, or DNA takes a long time before it changes on the basis of natural selection, et cetera, millennia maybe. Spontaneous mutations occur and so on. But there are proteins that sit on the genes and they turn the genes on and off. And those can be changed one generation to the next. And people who've experienced severe stress, PTSD-like stuff, they can actually pass that on to their progeny. And, oh my God, you can inherit PTSD. I mean,
and do, I would say. I think it's probably the rule, right?
Yes. So in a sense, we're dealing with the sins of our ancestors. I really don't want to use the word sins, but the experiences of our ancestors. And this thing with epigenetics, you know, think about what's happened over the past century where our diets have changed so much. You know, nutrients have been taken out, all sorts of junk has been put in, not to mention our sugar intakes going nuts. And then think of the hundreds of thousands of chemicals that humankind has been exposed to never before in human history. Over the past century, right? And then add to that the demise of the extended family and tight-knit communities, where if, God forbid, a kid was getting abused, they could go next door to an aunt, uncle, grandparent and get some succor. And now, you know, this is starting around 1980, nuclear families, single parent families, no parent families, you know, not that same sense of safety that occurred when we were surrounded by loved ones. It's very interesting. It's on a personal level. I have first cousins. I never see them. You know, they're distributed. So we all have the same grandparents. And we used to get together for reunions. It hasn't happened in like at least 6 years. But when we do, and we're hoping to this summer, when we do, I still feel an unconditional love from these people whom I don't even know, and I'm worried about how they're voting. You know, I still, you know, we all feel this belonging, right?
So powerful.
Isn't it powerful? And, okay, and if it's okay with you, I'm going to riff on that one, okay?
Sure.
Okay, well, you live in Allentown, and there is a town, if you go up the Delaware River, if you go up the Delaware River, there's a town named Roswell, I think. Okay, so in around 1960, some investigators at the University of Pennsylvania got interested in Roswell, Pennsylvania, because their rate of heart disease, then and now, which kills 50% of Americans, they had half the national average. And they were wondering, well, what's going on in this town? You know, a bunch of vegetarian marathon runners, what gives? Well, what they found was a bunch of sedentary Italians. And it is so fascinating now, you know, and I know, when I grew up in Allentown, there was the city of Allentown, and then there's farmland, right? So the cities were sort of well circumscribed back then. Now they just extend and have taken over a lot of that beautiful farmland. And so Roswell, Pennsylvania was
I think it's actually Rosetto. Rosetto.
Oh, Rosetta. Thank you. Thank you. Roswell's in New Mexico.
Yeah. Also famous for other interesting reasons, but go on about Rosetto. Exactly.
Thank you so much. So, okay. So, you know, there's towns nearby, and this one was Welsh, and that one was Polish anyway, and this one's Italian. What happened in Rosetta, Italy, is the quarries closed around the turn of the century, and families started coming to the New World, and a bunch of them came to this one place in Rosetta, and enough of them came that they actually went back and got their priest to come over. And they all went to the same church, and they did everything together. And interesting, the person who owned the factory lived next door to the people who worked there, and there was none of the socioeconomic differentiation. It was like one big family, and it wasn't only heart disease that they didn't have. They all sorts of medical illnesses. People were just dying of old age, and it's not like they had particularly healthy lifestyles as we would define that in terms of exercise, in terms of diet and so on. They didn't. So it was really quite fascinating. The researchers said they predicted in 20 years, they're going to have the same rate of heart disease as the rest of Americans, which was true. They could see that the adolescents no longer wanted to go to church on Sundays. They wanted to watch TV instead of hanging out with their friends and family. And this very tight-knit, large community was becoming more separated, people moving out. And it was sad, but, you know, no surprise, right?
Right, the protective barrier disintegrated, and then the usual outcome was predictable.
You know, I had a very interesting experience about Rosetta. I've always been so intrigued by the studies on this population, right? And so what I did was I just tried to imagine myself now, as you know, I grew up in Allentown on a street with a row of brick houses and stuff. And I said to myself, what was it like? What was it like to live there? And I just pictured myself, I'm on the concrete porch of this brick row house. I'm looking down a little bit of a valley and just this urban, old urban landscape. And here's what I felt. I had this internal experience. One is, I'm a totally average person. I don't really stand out in any significant way. Secondly, I'm totally accepted. I belong to this group. I belong to them. They belong to me. And I feel this acceptance. And then I just had this somatic experience that I could only describe as safety. Just this, like, I'm safe. And I thought to myself, oh my God, you know, what's happened to us in our lack of feeling that level of belonging and safety gets communicated to our children and then our grandchildren. And it's a snowball. And add that to the toxins that we're associated with and the diet that has changed so hugely in one century. And there are other factors as well, but we look at the epigenetics, and no wonder we're seeing all sorts of autoimmune problems and people dying of different kinds of cancers we didn't see before, and mental illness in particular. So that's my riff.
I want to know where that bluff was. That's near my house, probably. You said that's in the Lehigh Valley?
Yeah. Well, Roswell, you mean?
Oh, that was where you were? You were at Rosetta when you did that? Or I thought you were overlooking the valley here somewhere. No?
I was internally imagining myself.
Oh, you went into it this way. That's even cooler. So that means it's accessible for everyone. As you were talking about it, I was like, all I could keep thinking about was bees. And that must be like what bees feel, you know, so connected to the hive, so clear on their purpose, so kind of engulfed in this safety network of little, you know, honeycombs and other bees doing the same thing, and just average, everyone just being part of this beautiful working system where everybody belongs and has a purpose. That was my little internal trip that I took when you were talking about that.
I know, that's a really cool analogy. Yeah.
So speaking of internal trips, I really want to talk about your microdosing stuff, because I haven't heard anybody else talking about this for Lyme, and it's fascinating to me. And I love that you're actually doing it. You've written a paper on this. Can you give us kind of like the bird's eye, and then maybe drill down and talk about like what's going on now since you wrote that paper?
Sure. Okay. So we're talking about psilocybin. Psilocybin is known as a hallucinogenic mushroom. It's been illegal since the 1970s when Nixon did his war on drugs. So it's labeled class one as a pharmaceutical. But sometime in the early 2000s, the FDA started to allow studies. And interestingly, the studies have been done with macrodoses. So we're talking about hallucinogenic doses. In terms of dried mushrooms, it's usually starting at 3 up to 6 grams of mushrooms that people will take in a setting, a nice controlled setting with music and a therapist guide with clear-cut intention. So this is very different than just going out in nature and hallucinating and imagining whatever is going on out there. It's a very controlled setting, and it's very important that you have these intentions, like, here's what I'm looking for when I do this experience. And some of the early experiments were done with people who had terminal illness, basically most almost with cancer. Now, this is really interesting. So I graduated medical school in 1971. And when I took a neuroscience course, which would have been around 1968, 69, they showed a video to the class of Stanislav Grof, who's famous for holographic breathing, giving people LSD who had terminal cancer. watch this video and someone goes through this psychedelic journey and actually lived through their death. And then when they came back and awake, they're not afraid of dying anymore. And they could see their hearts are way open. They're hugging people. And that was my first introduction. I was like, whoa. And then Michael Pollan is writing about this in 2015 in The New Yorker. And so basically these are life-changing experiences, and they're using it to treat anxiety and depression and addiction disorders and so on. As you can imagine, these studies are not easy to do. You're talking about a 4 to 6 hour trip, you know, with a dedicated therapist who knows what they're doing. And but with really excellent results, okay? And actually, psilocybin is considered by the FDA to be a quote-unquote breakthrough therapy for depression. Okay, well, it's still, the FDA can still consider it illegal. It's still class one, but that hasn't stopped the states, particularly Colorado, proud to be a citizen of Colorado, who basically, I was going to say legalized, but more technically Denver decriminalized psilocybin. And but now it's been decriminalized in a lot of cities, and full dose treatment by therapists has been legalized in Colorado and in Oregon, and I know other states it's waiting to happen. Okay, so that's full dose. And that you really, if people are considering that, they really need to work with an experienced therapist guide. However, there's something called microdosing. The microdosing is using a very small amount on a regular basis, hoping to get the same benefits, okay? So we're talking usually between 100 milligrams and 300 milligrams versus 3,000 to 6,000 milligrams. We're talking about as low as 1/50th. And taking it, say, three times a week. Interestingly, if you take it every day, it doesn't work. It just stops working. Okay, so I had this patient that I wrote up that you alluded to and that I had published in sometime earlier this year. Title of the article was The Effectiveness of Microdose Psilocybin in the Treatment of Neuropsychiatric Lyme Disease Case Study. Okay, so here was a dude who had Lyme, Babesia, and Bartonella, and would occasionally have relapses. And when he relapsed, it was all neuropsychiatric, anxiety, panic attacks, suicidal depression, sleeplessness. And with this particular relapse, clearly his body had become sensitized and he wasn't tolerating anything. He would Herxheimer on almost everything that he was given. He tried some psychotropic meds. They didn't work before. They didn't work again. Having a lot of trouble coping, suicidal ideation, and panic attacks does not make for a fun life, right? Okay. And then his daughter says, why don't you try microdosing? So it turns out it's not hard to get a hold of this stuff. And so he started off on 100 milligrams. It was so interesting what he told me. He said the first day he took it, he didn't feel suicidal. He didn't feel great, but one day without wanting to kill yourself, it was like, well, that's a good day. But he had occasional good days by that definition. Then he had 3 days in a row of not feeling suicidal. And he said, oh my God, this stuff is working. It started working with the very first dose. And within a week or two, he was back to baseline. He was normal. It was quite amazing, right? Okay. So in the paper, I write about the studies that have been done on microdosing. And here's the awful thing. There are no good studies out there. You know, they're all retrospective, fill it in yourself kind of studies. No controls. And it would be so easy to do a study. You know, you're giving someone a control, someone the active agent in capsules. It would be so easy to do that study, and it hasn't been done yet. I pleaded with Brian Fallon, as you know, at Columbia to do it. And he's interested. He said, I'll do it, but I'm the one who had to get funding. So it's like, well, we're going to have to wait on it. So at any rate, when you do the research on psilocybin, it turns out it has some very important properties. One is it's a very strong stimulator of serotonin. It's a serotonin agonist. It directly stimulates these receptors that produce serotonin, specifically 5-HT2A receptor, as well as some other receptors. And there's some other reasons I won't get into that it may also increase dopamine. Okay. But it turns out to be a significant anti-neuroinflammatory. Hmm. And I really think that this patient that was treated with microdosing and had a very quick response to it, I think it's much more likely than not that the effect was mediated by its anti-neuroinflammatory action. So I can't produce any data, but I think that microdosing psilocybin, which has hardly any downside, might be an important intervention for all these patients who have autoimmune encephalitis. But I want to remind people that neuropsychiatric Lyme is autoimmune encephalitis. We're talking about inflammation in the brain caused by bugs that are not in the brain, usually. And well, we're coming full circle. Bartonella does it the worst. Bartonella, is a co-infection. It's very, very common. It's not well appreciated. The tests for it aren't very good. There's a couple labs that do a lot better job than others, but they're still far from 100%. I like Igenex, but there's also Galaxy. I would say those are the two top labs in terms of diagnosing it. But I would say most of my patients, and I'm curious if this is true for you, Kristen, we diagnose it clinically. Mm-hmm. If someone has severe neuropsychiatric symptoms disproportionate to their physical symptoms, I'll immediately suspect Bartonella. If someone has neuropsychiatric symptoms that include serious rage, I'll think of Bartonella. And then I just want to remind people, cat scratch disease, that's when you get scratched by a cat and then it might fester, might even get a lymphangitic streak. And allegedly 90% of them, your immune system will take care of it without antibiotics. But guess what? You get Bartonella in your system at that point. And then later on, who knows, emotional stress, get whacked in the head, get put on steroids for poison ivy, whatever. And
get
suddenly
COVID. Get COVID or a shot.
Good point. Or the shot. I can tell you that when I started seeing reactions in my patients to the COVID vaccine, usually it was Bartonella flaring. Bartonella is trigger happy.
Yeah, I've seen a lot more Lyme and EBV actually in my patients flaring from that. But of course, it's always all there, right? There's always someone on stage and the next person lining up to give you symptoms once that's treated. So. Yeah, it's been crazy. Wow. Yeah. So let me get back to this idea of microdosing reducing inflammation. So when I think about neuropsychiatric Lyme getting better, and I'm assuming he's still better since you wrote the paper that was last early in the year. Yeah.
Well, I wrote the paper was published a year ago. And I just mentioned, by the way, that the publisher was so impressed by this paper. It's gotten a huge amount of attention. I mean, many, many thousands of people have uploaded this paper. They asked me to be on their editorial board.
What did you say?
Well, they wanted me to commit to 4 years. And I said, no, no way. And they said, how about 2 years? And I said, no, 1 year. They said, okay. So I said, yes.
Micro commitment. Yeah. So here's my question. So a lot of people are familiar with this notion of steroids being anti-inflammatory. And we know as people who treat, Lyme, that people will come in having gone to ortho and maybe they got their knee injected with steroids. Maybe they got steroids put in their back for sciatica, and that reduces inflammation, reduces pain, but also, your immune system takes a hit with that. Are we concerned at all that the microdosing is causing the immune system to kind of slow down, and that's why we're having less inflammation, less symptoms?
I'm glad you asked that. The answer is no. No, there's no evidence that it suppresses the immune system. Thankfully, it's an anti-inflammatory that doesn't suppress the immune system. And we need to find more of these, as you know. I mean, inflammation is such a big deal in so many illnesses, including our chronic illnesses, heart disease, dementia, cancer. You know, inflammation is really the number one thing that ties all these things together. So I think that anything that reduces inflammation without suppressing the immune system is something that we should be looking into.
So is this gentleman going to be on microdosing for life, do you think?
You know, he has stopped it. Okay, he told me that he has stopped it a few weeks at a time. And then he thought maybe the depression was starting to come back and he didn't want a chance. And his actual thinking was, hey, listen, if this decreases neuroinflammation, great. I'm going to take it, even if I'm not treating any symptoms, because guess what? Dementia, you know, it's caused by a number of factors, but in particular, inflammation, you know, triggering the tau proteins and the amyloid production. Yep. So he wants to stay on it. Yeah.
So who shouldn't be on it?
Oh, well, I think someone with a history of psychosis is going to have to be really careful. And it's not going
to cause people to talk to trees or hallucinate because of the microness of the dose, it still could be a potential trigger.
Well, I just wouldn't want to be responsible for someone whose brain chemistry is that unstable. I'm not saying it would be a bad idea, but I'm saying that person with a history of psychosis, if they're going to do it, should be under some sort of professional caretaking and start at very low doses. And maybe it would be incredibly helpful, but I would still be very careful. And then let's say someone with severe environmental sensitivities, you can be allergic to mushrooms too. The nice thing is that if you're getting it on the street, which is sort of the way it works, for the most part, you're getting a dried mushroom. You're not getting a capsule with a white powder in it. Who the hell knows what's in that, in addition to what you think might be in it, right? It's just a dried mushroom. So it's pretty clean stuff. And like I said, if someone has serious sensitivities, I would start with a 25 to 50 milligram dose just to make sure you're not sensitive to it. And I don't think everyone has a good time. Now, you know, people microdosing shouldn't expect a good time in terms of, oh, now I'm happy, now I'm, you know, stoned like marijuana or something like that. I don't think they should feel anything when they're microdosing, other than as they take it, to feel more uplifted, less anxiety, less depression. There's a dude named James Fahneman, at Stanford, who actually contacted me after my paper came out. He's considered the father of microdosing. He's been around since the 60s and was doing research back then, before the research was shut down in the Nixon era. And he's written more. If people want to hear about microdosing, he's written books, and B, you can go on YouTube and see lectures by him. And he makes a distinction. He says, you know, antidepressants, if they're working, which they might work 50% of the time, if they're working, they help you not feel depression. Unfortunately, they sometimes help you not feel anything. But the microdosing of, and this applies to LSD too as well, but microdosing actually increases mood somewhat. And there are studies that suggest it increases creativity, and, you know, decreases anxiety and depression like it did in this dude. Maybe it depends on how much is is mediated by inflammation, or maybe it's just the serotonin agonist effect with decreased neuroinflammation. But I just want to again point out to the audience here that a lot of mental illness is associated with neuroinflammation. You don't have to have Lyme, anxiety, depression, bipolar, acute psychosis. Strong studies that link those with really significant neuroinflammation.
Yeah. So anything that is looking to bring that down could potentially be an avenue to pursue. Well, it's really helpful to hear your overview of microdosing. That's been the sort of most clear and coherent and kind of understandable pathway to how someone might get better with Lyme. And I really appreciate you walking us through that. Is there anything else you would want to say to this community of people who are really about learning tools and practices and different avenues for self-healing and for wellness that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, great. I mean, it's such, as you know, Kristen, it's such a big deal. It's such a big deal. We're dealing with imbalances throughout our bodies. 99% of doctors don't have a clue what's happening and how important it is to treat the whole person. I think the message I want to get across is there is always hope. And, you know, I really try to get that through. The vast majority of patients get better. And it can take time and it can be up and down, but to stick with it, you know, make sure you have a good support system and not give up. Just know that there's going to be ups and downs. When I was so depressed and really felt like my being on the earth plane was of no benefit to anyone, and if anything was a negative, I'd have to tell myself that I'm seeing the world through these very distorted lenses. And before I do anything radical, I need to get those lenses cleaned up. Like, I did feel joy in the past, even though I can't access it now. And just take it day by day until my lenses cleaned up. Mm-hmm. That's how I got through each day.
Wow. Such an important message and such a hopeful message. And I'm so grateful to you for all the work that you're doing, but also just really grateful for the last hour and your willingness to share some of these pearls that you've picked up along the way through, you know, truly hard won experience. So thank you.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate connecting, especially with someone from my hometown, Allentown.
Awesome.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Healing Grove podcast. If you liked it, please be sure to like and subscribe. And if you want to deepen your experience further, consider grabbing a copy of the Healing Grove playbook. With journal prompts for this podcast and 41 others, it's the perfect place to record your learnings, keep track of the tools you explore, and reflect on your own experience. Finally, it's important to mention that even though I am a doctor, nothing you hear on this podcast, whether from myself or my guests, constitutes medical advice. Any intervention you try should always be discussed with and supervised by a trusted member of your own healing team. Thanks for listening, and see you next time in the Healing Grove.